You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On today's program, we're presenting excerpts from last weekend's Project Censored Awards ceremony, honoring the journalists who uncovered the most relevant but underreported news stories of 2003. We continue now with Dennis Bernstein, host of Pacifica Radio's Flashpoints program, as he speaks with Martin Lee, a veteran media democracy activist and co-founder of the Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
We formed FAIR in 1986. Jeff Cohen and I were among the principal founders. At that time, 26 corporations owned and controlled more than half of the news media, not just news media, all media in the United States. 26, according to Ben Bagdikian's essential text, The Media Monopoly, that wonderful book. By the time we launched FAIR's magazine, Extra, a year after we launched FAIR, that was in 1987, the number had already dropped from 26 to 23, and since then it's been plummeting fast. Today, it's estimated by Bagdikian that only a half a dozen mega corporations own and control most of the media in the United States. And to me, that is scary. I mean, even if these corporations had nothing but the best intentions, if they were crusaders for social justice, which they are not, I mean, the bottom line with them is the bottom line. They're out to make money, not really sense. I mean, big money we're talking about. I think even if they were, you know, great institutions, it would be still scary to me, because that much power concentrated in so few corporate hands is inherently anti-democratic and very, very dangerous.
Well, now, what does that have to do with Project Censored and what they do in terms of recognizing certain stories?
I think corporate ownership, corporate advertising, has a lot to do with why Project Censored was formed in the first place. The Project Censored addresses what stories are underreported, what stories are neglected in the mainstream corporate-dominated media. What happens when you have reporters who are writing about stories that impinge upon the economic interests of the advertisers or the corporate owners? That happens quite often. We at FAIR would say that journalists who work within the corporate media are working in a media industry that has about as much to do with independent journalism as Safeway has to do with family farming. That's the problem today. It's one of the major factors, corporate ownership, that contributes to a lack of full-breadth reporting on the important issues of the day. Another obvious, very important factor is the fact that many journalists kowtow to politicians and elected officials. They're unduly influenced by official sources. When you put those two factors together, corporate ownership and an over-reliance on official sources, it's a very bad mix for a healthy media and a healthy democracy.
Well, Marty, one of the reasons I wanted you to join us tonight is because you've been taking a close look at what's been going on in Italy with the Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Now, Berlusconi and his relationship to the media there is really pre-sentiment. It's the perfect example of where we seem to be going here in the U.S. So why don't you talk a little bit about Berlusconi, the Prime Minister, and his relationship to the media?
Well, that is one nightmare vision that we may be heading towards. Silvio Berlusconi is a multi-billionaire real estate magnate. At least that's how he started out in Italy. He got himself elected prime minister in order to avoid going to jail on corruption charges, bribery charges, several other charges, criminal charges that were pending against him. The only way to avoid going to jail for Berlusconi was to build a political party out of whole cloth in the mid-1990s and get himself elected prime minister, which he did twice, and he is the current serving prime minister in Italy. He not only is a real estate magnate, but he has vast economic interests in Italy, including he's the owner of the three main private television stations. And now that he's prime minister, he dominates the entire media landscape, the four public television stations in Italy as well. He owns newspapers, magazines, and in addition to that. But television is the main, most influential media in societies today. And he has a really tight grip on the information in Italy. When a reporter in a magazine that he owns writes something that he doesn't like, that reporter will likely be fired. If a TV commentator says something that Berlusconi finds a little bit offensive or a little too catty or a little too uppity, that reporter is likely to be relieved of his position. It's happened many times. And again, it really underscores the confluence of economic power and political power. In Italy, for one person to be the leader of the country and have that kind of grip on the media, again, it's profoundly anti-democratic. And while, to compound the problem, Berlusconi is allied with neo-fascist forces in Italy. They're part of his government. But I don't think it's the neo-fascists that are the main problem in Italy. I think Berlusconi is the main problem. I think he's the most dangerous political threat in Europe today, the most dangerous threat to democracy, because of the kind of power he exercises over the media. And when we consider where we're going in the United States, right, there it's really one person, if you will, one corporation, one corporate complex that has the media monopoly in Italy. In the United States, well, we have six. What's the difference here? Well, I suppose six is better than one, but is there all that much difference? Given the fact that the media monopoly that exists, they share interests, they may compete over ratings, they may compete over market share, if you will, but they all lined up in the same side of the fence when it came to pushing the FCC to deregulate, so to speak, which has been thwarted to some degree by incredible grassroots activism, Project Censored has contributed to, we should add.
Now, this is a very interesting guy. Recently, he said he referred to Mussolini as being benign. He didn't kill people, he just sent them on vacation.
It's a rather warped view of history, Silvio Berlusconi.
And you were talking about what he could do in terms of a reporter, but here's somebody who's been indicted multiple times. He's shown to have certain connections with organized crime. What happens when a judge wants to go after him?
Well, he's been going after the judges. He's been giving the judges, the independent judiciary, a hard time. In Italy, he's been using his media companies to wage a campaign against the judiciary to make it that they're the problem, not that he's the problem.
And if a candidate wants to run against him, they have to advertise in his media.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird situation. How very bizarre for a democracy where the opponent, the opposing political party, have to take out ads and give money to the person they're running against. He's Citizen Kane on steroids is what Berlusconi is. That's how he's been described. It's a very appropriate description.
And Berlusconi is very interesting, Morty, because he is sort of a foreign neocon. Berlusconi is a good friend of George W. Bush. In fact, he recently had lunch at the ranch, and he fits in nicely with the whole new cabal of neocons that are now calling the shots. Project Censored has chosen that as a main focus, and their number one story has to do with the neoconservative plan for global domination. And with us is Shannon Service, and she's with the reporter who broke that story. Shannon?
Ready. I'm here with David Armstrong, whose article, Dick Cheney's Song of America, appeared in Harper's Magazine, and Mr. Armstrong is taking tonight's top honors. Mr. Armstrong, in your article, you outline what you call the plan, with a capital P. Can you tell us about the plan and who are the neoconservatives who are the architects of it?
The plan is really a strategy that was developed during the first Bush administration by Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell, and Dick Cheney as an answer to the end of the Cold War. With the demise of the Soviet Union, they saw an opportunity to consolidate U.S. power and enforce it throughout the world, essentially to enforce U.S. dominance through military strength. When that plan did not fly, when it was flatly rejected, as a matter of fact, by other countries who saw it as a naked power grab, it was shelved at the end of the first Bush administration, only to be re-resurrected at the beginning of the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, as an answer to the war on terrorism. It is the same strategy with a slightly different twist. They've moved from a theme of dominance to a theme of preemption as the major feature of the plan. But it is essentially the same plan under a new guise.
And what does that shift signify from dominance to preemption?
Well, it's really no shift at all in terms of the reality of how the plan plays out. It's really only a matter of where the public perceives the administration to be going. By focusing on preemption, they're able to justify it as a way of battling terrorist states or terrorist organizations. But fundamentally, the dominance theme remains the overarching plan for this administration.
Tell us about the role of media in this. How have the neoconservatives used the media to portray their message?
I think they learned a lesson the first time around. When this met with a very bad reaction in the first guise, they learned that it was not going to be a sellable plan as a strategy for the United States to effectively have hegemony. But when they posed it as a strategy for combating terrorism, people were much more willing to accept it, and they pounced on that opportunity and used it as a way of gaining public acceptance and selling it as this concept of preemption. So they've used the media effectively in selling it on those grounds.
Mr. Armstrong, thanks for joining us. We're going to go back now to Dennis, who will continue with Martin Lee.
Thank you. Morty, talk about the neocons a little bit more in the context that the mainstream media plays in helping them push their agenda along.
No, I think you put your finger on it, Dennis, because this is not just a very important story that's been underreported in the mainstream media. Mainstream media has been a central player in this story. I mean, neocons didn't come just out of whole cloth. I mean, Rupert Murdoch funds these people. Rupert Murdoch owns Fox TV network, among other media properties in the United States. He's funding the group, the Project for New American Century, which is the heart of the neoconservative cabal, led by Bill Kristol Jr. He funds the Weekly Standard. So here he has people coming on his networks, commenting about policies that the Bush administration is perpetrating, being advised by neocons, or being funded by Murdoch, who then come on his network to comment on the very policies that his network is funding. I mean, this in many ways was Rupert Murdoch's war, you know, but that whole aspect is totally missed in the media. So it's not just the media kind of misses a key part of the story. The media, in some sense, is the story here.
Now, let's take a look at that Weekly Standard, because this is a tiny news operation, and yet we see them being represented on some of the mainstream CNN, Fox, CNBC. How is it that such a small magazine gets such representation?
Well, they're considered the neoconservative flagship. They are funded by Murdoch, as you just mentioned. But when you look at the people who are around this, again, this neoconservative cabal, it's not that they just emerged from nowhere. I mean, they came from somewhere. This is the same group of people that were part of what was called Team B in the mid-1970s, when they came up with this idea that the Soviet Union really wasn't interested in detente, but was interested in any moment bombing the United States to smithereens. In fact, the Soviet Union was tottering, and it turned out to be on its last legs. But here was this Team B that was put together in order to provide a counter-analysis during the 1970s to those who were in the United States who were promoting detente. And they said, no, we can't promote detente because the Soviet Union is so dangerous, they want to beat the United States in a nuclear war. These people are so divorced from reality, fundamentally. And where are they today? They're running foreign policy in the United States. So again, you have to look at the roots of these people, which the media is not doing. And Weekly Standard isn't going to do it either because they're speaking for them.
Well, we're also going to take a look at the second story picked by Project Censored, and that has to do with Homeland Security and the police state in this country. And we can see now how the administration, how the neocons have used the attack on the Twin Towers, 9/11, to come down hard on civil liberties. And I think Project Censored made a good choice by focusing in on Homeland Security. And I believe that we've got Shannon Service with us, joined by Frank Morales.
We do, Dennis. Thank you very much. I am here with Mr. Morales, whose article appeared in Global Outlook, and it is about Homeland Security. Now, Mr. Morales, a couple of weeks ago, Boeing had a conference, co-sponsor of a conference in DC called Global Homeland Security, and they had presenters, everyone from the Department of Homeland Defense to Israel's information agency, Mossad, and participants included folks from the FBI, but also America's police officers. How much have we seen the government and military move into community affairs?
Well, since at least the late 60s, there's been a process referred to as a militarization of the police. This has been coupled, abroad by a process of the policization of the military, in which the military is being under the rubric of operations other than war. It's a process of defining new missions for the Pentagon, particularly in the area in the context of dealing with non-combatants and civilians. Homeland Defense, as a euphemism, was operative within the Pentagon within the mid-90s, and originally had to do with the whole question of civil disturbance suppression. After 9/11, it took on the kind of an air of dealing with terrorism, but essentially Homeland Defense is about mounting counterinsurgency against dissenting populations within America.
What does that look like?
Well, what it has to do with is an extension of the decades-old Operation Garden Plot plan, which is a contingency plan that the Pentagon has had in operation for quite a number of years now, essentially a 200-page document which details the means and tactics, techniques, and procedures, as the Pentagon likes to refer to, of dealing with dissent in America. Homeland Defense is a cover for the war on dissent within America. What we've seen more and more is the Bush folks, the corporate elite, taking a more direct, hands-on approach to the requirements that they see on the grassroots, so to speak. Under Clinton, for instance, there was a process known as technology transfer memorandums, which basically legalized the transfer of military technology, so-called non-lethal technology and so forth, to local police departments. We've seen the gradual erosion of the Posse Comitatus Act. The Posse Comitatus Act is an 1878 statute, which is the foundation upon which we separate the military from the police function. That criminal statute has been eroded since the 1980s through the so-called drug war, with various exceptions. As we speak right now, the Bush people have been reviewing the Posse Comitatus Act with an eye towards repealing it, and within the last week, there have been reports that the Posse Comitatus Act is about to be repealed. If this occurs, it'll represent a complete consolidation of the military and the police function within America, which is a requirement when you're waging global exploitation and domination abroad to have an internal security apparatus at home.
Now, why isn't the media all over this? What's the importance of information control to the kind of security that you're talking about?
Well, the kind of information control we're referring to is the reason for groups like Project Censored. For instance, there are very few people who realize that in August of 2001, the Pentagon issued the Joint Chiefs JAG office. In other words, their legal eagles at the Joint Chiefs issued what is referred to as a domestic operations manual. Now, some people would see this as a contradiction in terms, that the Pentagon would actually be issuing a domestic operations
manual. Because the Pentagon is supposed to operate abroad and
exactly.
Not domestic.
So what we're seeing is, with the militarization of the police, the complete consolidation of the military and police function within America, such that recently this manual has been published, a third of which, it's a roughly 200-page document, a third of which deals with civil disturbance suppression. So, I mean, it's very clear to those of us who've been looking at the Pentagon over the last decade or so that the shift under the doctrinal rubric of operations other than war, okay, dealing with non-combatant and civilian populations is what we're looking at with the Homeland Defense Apparatus, which is a counterinsurgency effort directed at the American people.
Thank you, Mr. Morales. Dennis?
Thank you.
And thanks, Shannon Service. And that's a very salient point, the point that Frank Morales makes. When you think about the evolution into fascism, a key aspect of that is the clouding of the relationship between the military and domestic law enforcement. And we see that happening more and more in this country. And it's a very dangerous, slippery slope, particularly, Marty Lee, for journalists trying to investigate government officials. You're now being faced with, are you a terrorist? Are you undermining our fight against terrorism?
It's curious, this phrase, homeland security. I mean, where did it come from? We used to hear about national security all the time, before 9/11. National security this, national security that. And then all of a sudden now it's homeland security. And I'm sort of wondering, well, why do we have two phrases? I mean, isn't our homeland, our nation, why not
well,
just national security? I don't know about the origin, but you know, it seems to me that that national security is a phrase that referred to U.S. government policies that abused and trampled people's rights in other countries. Homeland security is a phrase that refers to policies that abuse and violate human rights in this country. I guess that's the difference. That's why they have two phrases.
Now, what's interesting, Marty, and I know that you know this, that we understand that whatever policy the U.S. government is fostering abroad, we can see a parallel structure at home. So now we're into the days of preemptive strikes. We have preemptive strikes allegedly against terrorists, and we have preemptive strikes here at home. Latest book is The Beast Reawakens. It's about the resurgence of fascism in Europe and the United States. Do you think this kind of policy plays into it? Are you concerned?
Yes, and it's a process that's been in play now for, not just since 9/11. I mean, this militarization of the police has been happening slowly over time. Garden plot is something we heard about back in the early 70s. I remember first hearing about it at that time. So, you know, it reminds me of that phrase, bringing the war back home, that the demonstrators, the anti-war demonstrators in the 60s talked about. Well, in a way, it's coming back home in ways that we hadn't perhaps anticipated.
Yeah, and now fascism's got a Brooks Brothers suit. And we should spend a minute talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger, because he represents that kind of cleaned up, potential supporter of what, or is it potential, or is he a supporter of white supremacy?
Well, he had been as a young man, he admits, as a child, as a youth, an admirer of Adolf Hitler. That's not a secret anymore, though it's a little bit odd that it should surface so late in this campaign, in his campaign for governor. Today, he's still affiliated with the group U.S. English, which is ostensibly devoted toward restricting immigration and promoting English as the official language in the United States. It has a rather nasty agenda underneath that that it pursues, and that it's affiliated with white supremacist organizations, that group. Key figures in it have been involved with David Duke and others, David Duke, the neo-Nazi today. And when the racist component of this organization first began to surface back in 1989, a year after Arnold Schwarzenegger joined the board of advisors of U.S. English, several people left the organization, several advisors. Walter Cronkite was one. Linda Chavez, a Reagan administration appointee, was another. They left because of the racist remarks that came across in memos that were leaked about U.S. English from the founder of the group, John Tanton. Schwarzenegger apparently wasn't bothered by this or was not aware of this, and he stayed on. And even though more information about the ties between U.S. English and white supremacists, overtly, explicitly white supremacist groups in the United States, recently surfaced in the Washington Post, still Schwarzenegger stays on. And to me, let's grant him the benefit of doubt. I don't know if he deserves it, but let's interpret it benevolently, as it were. Let's say he just didn't realize what this organization is about. Well, then he's not very competent. What is it, you know? I mean, this is a political organization. He's affiliated with it. He gives them a kind of imprimatur, gives them a respectability because of who he is. He helps the organization. I mean, he should know by now he shouldn't be affiliated with it. So either it doesn't bother him, or he's just oblivious to what's going on. And either way you interpret it, it doesn't bode well for Governor Schwarzenegger, if that indeed is what we're going to be faced with in California.
We broke a story on Pacifica Radio about what appears to be some hush money paid to silence somebody who was going to write a book and include some of these extraordinary comments by Schwarzenegger.
In essence, what had happened, they were filming a documentary called Pumping Iron about his bodybuilding exploits. And in part of the footage, they had him talking about how Hitler was, how he admired Hitler because of, for whatever reasons. And Schwarzenegger, when he realized he was going to pursue some political ambitions in the early 1990s, he decided he had to clean up that skeleton in the closet. So he wanted to purchase this footage, and he bought it back from the producer, behind the backs from the producer's investors. This is a bit of a minor scandal that has erupted just within the last 24 hours. It's been getting some play in the news media.
Well, thank you. We're going to go back to Shannon Service. I believe she's out there with another one of the winners. What do you have for us, Shannon?
Well, Dennis, I'm here with Matt Bowles, who wrote an article in Left Turn magazine entitled U.S. Aid, Lifeblood of the Occupation, referring, of course, to Israel's occupation of Palestine, with mirrors to the occupation of Palestine being a mirror of the United States' occupation of Iraq. So tell us specifically, how does U.S. Aid fuel the occupation?
Well, about one-third of the American foreign aid budget every year goes to fund an illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. American tax dollars, since the very inception of the Israeli state, have been funding the colonization of Palestinian land.
How?
Well, about $3 billion a year of our tax money goes over to Israel, and it goes into a general fund. So it's not specified for any in particular thing. It goes into the general fund, and so they use it to build settlements. They go systematically into Palestinian land, building settlements, destroying Palestinian villages, destroying Palestinian infrastructure, and then reconstructing an Israeli colonial society on top of that. This has been going on since the inception of the State of Israel. It's continuing to go on today, and it's been especially exacerbated by the neoconservative regime that's just come into power, which has taken a much more right-wing alliance, a much more brash approach to empire building in the Middle East in general, of which Israel is a central component.
How has this story played out in American media?
The American media, the situation in Palestine, the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian resistance, and the struggle of these people have been systematically kept out of American media. It's one of the most censored stories of the last 50 years. And that's been part and parcel for the U.S. to support Israel, which has functioned basically as a proxy army in the Middle East, so the U.S. can control the oil reserves, specifically because those fund the economies of Europe and Japan, so the U.S. remains control over that. And if the American taxpayers knew the amount of destruction and the war crimes that their tax dollars were funding, you know, they wouldn't be having it. And so the media needs to keep that completely out of the mainstream.
Matt Bowles is the author of the 24 most censored news stories of 2003. According to the group Project Censored, we'll have more from last weekend's awards ceremony, including a speech by former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney on tomorrow's program. On a final note tonight, this is our last week here at Peace Watch. Our program will come to an end this Friday after a week of specials, speeches, and material from our archives. We've thoroughly enjoyed producing this show over the past year, and we thank all of our listeners and supporters for their generous feedback and support, monetary and otherwise, which kept us going for so long. Our staff is entering planning and production for a brand new show with a broader focus to be launched November 3rd on most Pacifica stations and affiliates. Stay tuned for further information and broadcast times. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.